You're listening to the Stephen Wolfram Podcast, an exploration of thoughts and ideas from the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, creator of Wolfram Alpha and the Wolfram Language. In this second part in a two-part podcast, Stephen revisits his blog post reflecting on a 15-year view of a new kind of science and its implications for mathematics, controlling artificial intelligence, and the economy of mining the computational universe. Let's have a listen.
When I wrote A New Kind of Science, I viewed it in no small part as an effort to break away from the use of mathematics, at least as a foundation for science. But one of the things I realized is that the ideas in the book also have a lot of implications for pure mathematics itself. What is mathematics? Well, it's a study of certain abstract kinds of systems based on things like numbers and geometry. In a sense, it's exploring a small corner of the computational universe of all possible abstract systems. But still, plenty has been done in mathematics. Indeed, the 3 million or so published theorems of mathematics represent perhaps the largest single coherent intellectual structure that our species has built. Ever since Euclid, people have at least notionally imagined that mathematics starts from certain axioms, say, A plus B equals B plus A, or A plus 0 equals A, and so on, then builds up derivations of theorems. Why is math hard? The answer is fundamentally rooted in the phenomenon of computational irreducibility, which here is manifest in the fact that there's no general way to shortcut the series of steps needed to derive a theorem. In other words, it can be arbitrarily hard to get a result in mathematics. But worse than that, as Gödel's theorem showed, there can be mathematical statements where there just aren't any finite ways to prove or disprove them from the axioms. And in such cases, the statements just have to be considered undecidable. And in a sense, what's remarkable about math is that one can usefully do it at all, because it could be that most mathematical results one cares about would be undecidable. So why doesn't that happen? Well, if one considers arbitrary abstract systems, it happens a lot. Take a typical cellular automaton or Turing machine and ask whether it's true that the system, say, always settles down to periodic behavior regardless of its initial state. Even something as simple as this will often be undecidable. So why doesn't this happen in mathematics? Maybe there's something special about the particular axioms used in mathematics. And certainly if one thinks they're ones that uniquely describe science and the world, there might be a reason for that. But one of the whole points of the book is that actually there's a whole computational universe of possible rules that can be useful for doing science and describing the world. And in fact, I don't think there's anything abstractly special about the particular axioms that have traditionally been used in mathematics. I think they're just accidents of history. What about the theorems that people investigate in mathematics? Again, I think there's a strong historical character to them. For all but the most trivial areas of mathematics, there's a whole sea of undecidability out there. But somehow mathematics picks the islands where theorems can actually be proved, often priding itself on places close to the sea of undecidability where the proof can only be done with great effort. I've been interested in the whole network of published theorems in mathematics. It's a thing to curate, like wars in history or properties of chemicals. And one of the things I'm curious about is whether somehow there's an inexorable sequence to the mathematics that's done, or whether, in a sense, random parts are being picked. And here I think there's a considerable analogy to the kind of thing we were discussing before with language. What is a proof? Basically, it's a way of explaining to someone why something is true. I've made all sorts of automated proofs in which there are hundreds of steps, each perfectly verifiable by computer. But like the innards of a neural net, what's going on looks alien and not understandable by a human. For a human to understand, there must be familiar conceptual waypoints. It's pretty much like with words and languages. If some particular part of a proof has a name, Smith's theorem, and has a known meaning, then it's useful to us. But if it's just a lump of undifferentiated computation, it won't be meaningful to us. In pretty much any axiom system, there's an infinite set of possible theorems. But which ones are interesting? That's really a human question, and basically it's going to end up being ones with stories. In the book, I show that for the simple case of basic logic, the theorems that have historically been considered interesting enough to be given names happen to be precisely the ones that are in some sense minimal. But my guess is that for richer axiom systems, pretty much anything that's going to be considered interesting is going to have to be reached from things that are already considered interesting. It's like building up words or concepts. You don't get to introduce new ones unless you can directly relate them to existing ones. In recent years, I've wondered quite a bit about how inexorable or not progress is in a field like mathematics. Is there just one historical path that can be taken, say from arithmetic to algebra to the higher reaches of modern mathematics? or are there an infinite diversity of possible paths with completely different histories for mathematics? The answer is going to depend, in a sense, on the structure of metamathematical space. Just what is the network of true theorems that avoid the sea of undecidability? Maybe it'll be different for different fields of mathematics, and some will be more inexorable, so it feels like the math is being discovered, than others, where it seems more like the math is arbitrary and invented. But to me, one of the most interesting things is how close, when viewed in these kinds of terms, questions about the nature and character of mathematics end up being to questions about the nature and character of intelligence in AI. And it's this kind of commonality that makes me realize just how powerful in general the ideas in a new kind of science actually are. There's some areas of science, like physics and astronomy, where the traditional mathematical approach has done quite well. But there are others, like biology, social science, linguistics, where it's had a lot less to say. And one of the things I've long believed is that what's needed to make progress in these areas is to generalize the kinds of models one's using to consider a broader range of what's out there in the computational universe. And indeed, in the past 15 or so years, there's been increasing success in doing this. And there are lots of biological and social systems, for example, where models have now been constructed using simple programs. But unlike with mathematical models, which can potentially be solved, these computational models often show computational irreducibility and are typically used by doing explicit simulations. While this can be perfectly successful for making particular predictions or for applying the models in technology, but a bit like for the automated proofs of mathematical theorems, one might still ask, is this really science? Yes, one can simulate what a system does, but does one understand it? Well, the problem is that computational irreducibility implies that in some fundamental sense, one can't always understand things. There might be no useful story that can be told. There might be no conceptual waypoints, only lots of detailed computation. Imagine that one's trying to make a science of how the brain understands language, one of the big goals of linguistics. Well, perhaps we'll get an adequate model of the precise rules which determine the firing of neurons or some other low-level representation of the brain, and then we look at the patterns generated in understanding some whole collection of sentences. Well, what if those patterns look like the behavior of Rule 30, or closer at hand, the innards of some recurrent neural network? Can we tell a story about what's happening? To do so would basically require that we create some kind of higher-level symbolic representation, something where we effectively have words for core elements of what's going on. But computational irreducibility implies that there may ultimately be no way to create such a thing. Yes, it will always be possible to find patches of computational reducibility where some things can be said, but there won't be a complete story that can be told. And one might say that there won't be a useful reductionistic piece of science to be done. And that's just one of the things that happens when one's dealing, as the title says, with a new kind of science. People have gotten very worried about AI in recent years. They wonder what's going to happen when AIs get much smarter than us humans. Well, the principle of computational equivalence has one piece of good news. At some fundamental level, AIs will never be smarter. They'll just be able to do computations that are ultimately equivalent to what our brains do, or for that matter, what all sorts of simple programs do. As a practical matter, of course, AIs will be able to process larger amounts of data more quickly than actual brains, and no doubt we'll choose to have them run many aspects of the world for us, from medical devices to central banks to transportation systems and much more. So then it's important to figure out how we'll tell them what to do. As soon as we're making serious use of what's out there in the computational universe, we're not going to be able to give a line-by-line description of what the AIs are going to do. Rather, we're going to have to define goals for the AIs, then let them figure out how best to achieve those goals. In a sense, we've already been doing something like this for years in the Wolfram language. There's some high-level function that describes something you want to do, lay out a graph, classify data, and so on. Then it's up to the language to automatically figure out the best way to do it. And in the end, the real challenge is to find a way to describe goals. Yes, you want to search for cellular automata that will make a nice carpet pattern, or a good edge detector. But what exactly do those things mean? What you need is a language that a human can use to say as precisely as possible what they mean. It's really the same problem as I've been talking about a lot here. One has to have a way for humans to be able to talk about the things they care about. There's infinite detail out there in the computational universe, but through our civilization and our shared cultural history, we've come to identify certain concepts that are important to us. And when we describe our goals, it's in terms of these concepts. 300 years ago, people like Leibniz were interested in finding a precise symbolic way to represent the content of human thoughts and human discourse. He was far too early. But now I think we're finally in a position to make this work. In fact, we've already gotten a long way with the Wolfram language in being able to describe real things in the world. And I'm hoping that it'll be possible to construct a fairly complete symbolic discourse language that lets us talk about the things we care about. Right now, we write legal contracts in legalese as a way to make them slightly more precise than ordinary natural language. But with a symbolic discourse language, we'll be able to write true computational contracts that describe in high-level terms what we want to have happen, and then machines will automatically be able to verify or execute these contracts. But what about the AIs? Well, we need to tell them what we generally want them to do. We need to have a contract with them, or maybe we need to have a constitution for them. And it'll be written in some kind of symbolic discourse language that both allows us humans to express what we want and is executable by the AIs. There's a lot to say about what should be in an AI constitution and how the construction of such things might map onto the political and cultural landscape of the world. But one of the obvious questions is, can the constitution be simple, like Asimov's laws of robotics? And here what we know from A New Kind of Science tells us the answer. It can't be. In a sense, the constitution is an attempt to sculpt what can happen in the world and what can't. But computational irreducibility says that there will always be an unbounded collection of cases to consider. For me, it's interesting to see how theoretical ideas like computational irreducibility end up impinging on these very practical and central societal questions. Yes, it all started with questions about things like the theory of all possible theories, but in the end, it turns into issues that everyone in society is going to end up being concerned about. So, will we reach the end of science? Will we or our AIs eventually invent everything there is to be invented? For mathematics, it's easy to see that there's an infinite number of possible theorems one can construct. For science, there's an infinite number of possible detailed questions to ask, and there's also an infinite array of possible inventions one can construct. But the real question is, will there always be interesting new things out there? Well, computational irreducibility says there will always be new things that need an irreducible amount of computational work to reach from what's already there. So in a sense, there'll always be surprises that aren't immediately evident from what's come before. But will it just be like an endless array of different weirdly shaped rocks? Or will there be new fundamental features that appear that we humans consider interesting? It's back to the very same issue we've encountered several times before. For us humans to find things interesting, we have to have a conceptual framework that we can use to think about them. Yes, we can identify a persistent structure in a cellular automaton. Then maybe we can start talking about collisions between structures. But when we just see a whole mess of stuff going on, it's not going to be, quote, interesting to us unless we have some higher-level symbolic way to talk about it. In a sense, then, the rate of interesting discovery isn't going to be limited by our ability to go out into the computational universe and find things. Instead, it's going to be limited by our ability as humans to build a conceptual framework for what we're finding. It's a bit like what happened in the whole development of what became A New Kind of Science. People had seen related phenomena for centuries, if not millennia, things like distribution of primes, digits of pi, and so on. But without a conceptual framework, they just didn't seem interesting, and nothing was built around them. And indeed, as I understood more about what's out there in the computational universe, and even about things I saw long ago there, I gradually built up a conceptual framework that lets me go further. By the way, it's worth realizing that inventions work a little differently from discoveries. One can see something new happen in the computational universe, and that might be a discovery. But an invention is about figuring out how something can be achieved in the computational universe. And like in patent law, it isn't really an invention if you just say, look, this does that. You have to somehow understand a purpose that it's achieving. In the past, the focus of the process of invention has tended to be on actually getting something to work. Find the light bulb filament that works, and so on. But in the computational universe, the focus shifts to the question of what you want the invention to do. Because once you've described the goal, finding a way to achieve it is something that can be automated. That's not to say it will always be easy. In fact, computational irreducibility implies that it can be arbitrarily difficult. Let's say you know the precise rules by which some chemicals can interact. Can you find a chemical synthesis pathway that will let you get to some particular chemical structure? There may be a way, but computational irreducibility implies that there may be no way to find out how long the pathway will be. And if you haven't found a pathway, you may never be sure if it's because there isn't one or just because you didn't reach it yet. If one thinks about reaching the edge of science, one can't help but wonder what about the fundamental theory of physics. Given everything we've seen in the computational universe, is it conceivable that our physical universe could just correspond to one of those programs out there in the computational universe? Of course, we won't really know until or unless we find it. But in the years since A New Kind of Science appeared, I've become ever more optimistic about the possibilities. Needless to say, it will be a big change for physics. Today, there are basically two major frameworks for thinking about fundamental physics: general relativity and quantum field theory. General relativity is a bit more than 100 years old, quantum field theory maybe 90. And both have achieved spectacular things, but neither has succeeded in delivering us a complete fundamental theory of physics. And if nothing else, I think after all this time, it's worth trying something new. But there's another thing. From actually exploring the computational universe, we have a huge amount of intuition about what's possible, even in very simple models. We might have thought that the kind of richness we know exists in physics would require some very elaborate underlying model, but what's become clear is that that kind of richness can perfectly well emerge even from a very simple underlying model. What might this underlying model be like? I'm not going to discuss this in great detail here, but suffice it to say that I think the most important thing about the model is that it should have as little as possible built in. We shouldn't have the hubris to think we know how the universe is constructed. We should just take a general type of model that's as unstructured as possible and do what we typically do in the computational universe, just search for a program that does what we want. My favorite formulation for a model that's as unstructured as possible is a network, just a collection of nodes with connections between them. It's perfectly possible to formulate such a model as an algebraic-like structure and probably many other kinds of things, but we can think of it as a network. And the way I've imagined setting it up, it's a network that's somehow underneath space and time. Every aspect of space and time as we know it must emerge from the actual behavior of the network. Over the past decade or so, there's been increasing interest in things like loop quantum gravity and spin networks. They're related to what I've been doing in the sense that they also involve networks. And maybe there's some deeper relationship, but in their usual formulation, they're much more mathematically elaborate. From the point of view of the traditional methods of physics, this might seem like a good idea. But with the intuition we have from studying the computational universe and using it for science and technology, it seems completely unnecessary. Yes, we don't know the fundamental theory of physics, but it seems sensible to start with the simplest hypothesis, and that's definitely something like a simple network of the kind I've studied. At the outset, it'll look pretty alien to people, including myself, trained in traditional theoretical physics. But some of what emerges isn't so alien. A big result I found nearly 20 years ago that still hasn't been widely understood is that when you look at a large enough network of the kind I studied, you can show that its average behavior follows Einstein's equations for gravity. In other words, without putting any fancy physics into the underlying model, it ends up automatically emerging. I think it's pretty exciting. People ask a lot about quantum mechanics. Yes, my underlying model doesn't build in quantum mechanics, just as it doesn't build in general relativity. Now, it's a little difficult to pin down exactly what the essence of being quantum mechanical actually is, but there are some very suggestive signs that my simple networks actually end up showing what amounts to quantum behavior, just like in the physics we know. Okay, so how would one set about actually finding the fundamental theory of physics if it's out there in the computational universe of possible programs? Well, the obvious thing is just to start searching for it, starting with the simplest programs. I've been doing this, more sporadically than I would like, for the past 15 years or so, and my main discovery so far is that it's actually quite easy to find programs that aren't obviously not our universe. There are plenty of programs where space or time are obviously completely different from the way they are in our universe, or there's some other pathology. But it turns out that it's not so difficult to find candidate universes that aren't obviously not our universe. But we're immediately bitten by computational irreducibility. We can simulate the candidate universe for billions of steps, but we don't know what it's going to do and whether it's going to grow up to be like our universe or completely different. It's pretty unlikely that in looking at that tiny fragment of the very beginning of the universe, we're going to ever be able to see anything familiar like a photon. And it's not at all obvious that we'll be able to construct any kind of descriptive theory or effective physics. But in a sense, the problem is bizarrely similar to the one we have even in systems like neural networks. There's a computation going on there, but can we identify conceptual waypoints from which we can build up a theory that we might understand? It's not at all clear that our universe has to be understandable at that level. And it's quite possible that for a very long time we'll be left in the strange situation of thinking we might have found our universe out in the computational universe, but not being sure. Of course, we might be lucky, and it might be possible to deduce an effect of physics and see that some little program that we found ends up reproducing our whole universe. It would be a remarkable moment for science, but it would immediately raise a host of new questions, like, why this universe and not another? Right now, us humans exist as biological systems, but in the future it's certainly going to be technologically possible to reproduce all the processes in our brains in some purely digital, computational form. So insofar as those processes represent us, we're going to be able to be virtualized on pretty much any computational substrate. And in this case, we might imagine that the whole future of civilization could wind up in effect as a box of a trillion souls. Inside that box, there will be all kinds of computations going on, representing the thoughts and experiences of all those disembodied souls. Those computations would reflect the rich history of our civilization and all the things that have happened to us. But at some level, they wouldn't be anything special. It's perhaps a bit disappointing, but the principle of computational equivalence tells us that ultimately those computations will be no more sophisticated than the ones that go on in all sorts of other systems, even ones with simple rules and no elaborate history of civilization. Yes, the details will reflect all that history, but in a sense, without knowing what to look for or what to care about, one won't be able to tell that there's anything special about it. Okay, but what about for the souls themselves? Will one be able to understand their behavior by seeing that they achieve certain purposes? Well, in our current biological existence, we have all sorts of constraints and features that give us goals and purposes, but in a virtualized, uploaded form, most of these just go away. I've thought quite a bit about how human purposes might evolve in such a situation, recognizing, of course, that in virtualized form, there's little difference between human and AI. The disappointing vision is that perhaps the future of our civilization consists in disembodied souls, in effect playing video games for the rest of eternity. But what I've slowly realized is that it's actually quite unrealistic to project our view of goals and purposes from our experience today into that future situation. Imagine talking to someone from 1,000 years ago and trying to explain that people in the future will be walking on treadmills every day or continually sending photographs to their friends. The point is that such activities don't make sense until the cultural framework around them has developed. It's the same story yet again as with trying to characterize what's interesting or what's explainable. It relies on the development of a whole network of conceptual waypoints. Can we imagine what the mathematics of 100 years from now will be like? It depends on concepts we don't yet know. So similarly, if we try to imagine human motivation in the future, it's going to rely on concepts we don't know. Our best description from today's viewpoint might be that those disembodied souls are just playing video games. But to them, there might be a whole subtle motivation structure that they could only explain by rewinding all sorts of steps of history and cultural development. By the way, if we know the fundamental theory of physics, then in a sense we can make the virtualization complete, at least in principle. We can just run a simulation of the universe for those disembodied souls. Of course, if that's what's happening, then there's no particular reason it has to be a simulation of our particular universe. It could as well be any universe from out there in the computational universe. Now, as I mentioned, even in any given universe, one will never in a sense run out of things to do or discover. But I suppose I myself at least find it amusing to imagine that at some point those disembodied souls might get bored with just being in a simulated version of our physical universe and might decide it's more fun, whatever that means to them, to go out and explore the broader computational universe. Which would mean that, in a sense, the future of humanity will be an infinite voyage of discovery in the context of none other than a new kind of science. Long before we have to think about disembodied human souls, we'll have to confront the issue of what humans should be doing in a world where more and more can be done automatically by AIs. Now, in a sense, this issue is nothing new, it's just an extension of the long-running story of technology and automation. But somehow this time it feels different. And I think the reason is, in a sense, just that there's so much out there in the computational universe that's so easy to get to. Yes, we can build a machine that automates some particular task. We can even have a general-purpose computer that can be programmed to do a full range of different tasks. But even though these kinds of automation extend what we can do, it still feels like there's effort that we have to put into them. But the picture now is different, because in effect what we're saying is that if we can just define the goal we want to achieve, then everything else will be automatic. All sorts of computation and, yes, thinking may have to be done, but the idea is that it's just going to happen without human effort. At first, something seems wrong. How could we get all this benefit without putting in more effort? It's a bit like asking how nature could manage to make all the complexity it does, even though when we build artifacts, even with great effort, they end up far less complex. The answer, I think, is it's mining the computational universe. And it's exactly the same thing for us. By mining the computational universe, we can achieve essentially an unbounded level of automation. If we look at the important resources in today's world, many of them still depend on actual materials. And often those materials are literally mined from the Earth. Of course, there are accidents of geography and geology that determine by whom and where that mining can be done. And in the end, there's a limit, if often very large, to the amount of material that will ever be available. But when it comes to the computational universe, there's in a sense an inexhaustible supply of material, and it's accessible to anyone. Yes, there are technical issues about how to do the mining, and there's a whole stack of technology associated with doing it well, but the ultimate resource of the computational universe is a global and infinite one. There's no scarcity and no reason to be expensive. One just has to understand that it's there and take advantage of it. Probably the greatest intellectual shift of the past century has been the one towards the computational way of thinking about things. I've often said that if one picks almost any field X, from archaeology to zoology, then by now there either is or soon will be a field called computational X, and it's going to be the future of the field X. I myself have been deeply involved in trying to enable such computational fields, in particular through the development of the Wolfram language, but I've also been interested in what is essentially the meta problem. How should one teach abstract computational thinking, for example, to kids? The Wolfram language is certainly important as a practical tool, but what about the conceptual theoretical foundations? Well, that's where a new kind of science comes in, because at its core, it's discussing the pure abstract phenomenon of computation, independent of its applications to particular fields or tasks. It's a bit like with elementary mathematics. There are things to teach and understand just to introduce the ideas of mathematical thinking independent of their specific applications. And so it is, too, with the core of a new kind of science. There are things to learn about the computational universe that give intuition and introduce patterns of computational thinking quite independent of detailed applications. One can think of it as a kind of pre-computer science or pre-computational X. Before one gets into discussing the specifics of particular computational processes, one can just study the simple but pure things one finds in the computational universe. And yes, even before kids learn to do arithmetic, it's perfectly possible for them to fill out something like a cellular automaton coloring book or to execute for themselves or on a computer a whole range of different simple programs. What does it teach? Well, it certainly teaches the idea that there can be definite rules or algorithms for things, and that if one follows them, one can create useful and interesting results. And yes, it helps that systems like cellular automata make obvious visual patterns that, for example, one can find in nature, say, on mollusk shells. As the world becomes more computational and more things get done by AIs and by mining the computational universe, there's going to be an extremely high value, not only in understanding computational thinking, but also in having the kind of intuition that develops from exploring the computational universe, and that is, in a sense, the foundation for a new kind of science. You know, my goal over the decade that I spent writing A New Kind of Science was as much as possible to answer all the first round of obvious questions about the computational universe. And looking back 15 years later, I think it worked out pretty well. Indeed, today, when I wonder about something to do with the computational universe, I find it incredibly likely that somewhere in the main text or notes of the book, I already said something about it. But one of the biggest things that's changed over the past 15 years is that I've gradually begun to understand more of the implications of what the book describes. There are lots of specific ideas and discoveries in the book, but in the longer term, I think what's most significant is how they serve as foundations, both practical and conceptual, for a whole range of new things that one can now understand and explore. But even in terms of the basic science of the computational universe, there are certainly specific results one would like to get. For example, it would be great to get more evidence for or against the principle of computational equivalence and its domain of applicability. Like most general principles in science, the whole epistemological status of the principle of computational equivalence is somewhat complicated. Is it like a mathematical theorem that can be proved? Is it like a law of nature that might or might not be true about the universe? Or is it like a definition, say, of the very concept of computation? Well, much like, say, the second law of thermodynamics or evolution by natural selection, it's a combination of these. But one thing that's significant is that it's possible to get concrete evidence for or against the principle of computational equivalence. The principle says that even systems with very simple rules should be capable of arbitrarily sophisticated computation, so that in particular they should be able to act as universal computers. And indeed, one of the results of the book is that this is true for one of the simplest possible cellular automata, Rule 110. 5 years after the book was published, I decided to put up a prize for evidence about another case, the simplest conceivably universal Turing machine. And I was very pleased that in just a few months the prize was won, the Turing machine was proved universal, and there was another piece of evidence for the principle of computational equivalence. There's a lot to do in developing the applications of a new kind of science. There are models to be made of all sorts of systems. There's technology to be found, art to be created. There's also a lot to do in understanding the implications. But it's important not to forget the pure investigation of the computational universe. In the analogy of mathematics, there are applications to be pursued, but there's also a pure mathematics that's worth pursuing in its own right. And so it is with the computational universe. There's a huge amount to explore just at an abstract level. And indeed, as the title of the book implies, there's enough to define a whole new kind of science, a pure science of the computational universe. And it's the opening of that new kind of science that I think is the core achievement of a new kind of science, and the one of which I'm most proud.
You've been listening to the Stephen Wolfram Podcast. You can read more about a new kind of science at wolframscience.com. And for more information on Stephen's other publications, live coding streams, and this podcast, visit stephenwolfram.com.